Hello and welcome to At the Letters for Thursday, June 27th, 2024. Ben Nicholson-Smith here with you, alongside Arden Zwelling, on this episode of ATL, produced by Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. Thanks for being with us here midway through the season, approaching the 81-game mark for the Blue Jays, or I should say the 80-game mark for the Toronto Blue Jays here on Thursday, ahead of this series against the New York Yankees. And Arden, it's kind of wild because it's June and I feel like they've been in this holding pattern. The Blue Jays have essentially been in this kind of, hey, are we in it? Are we not? Mode for like 6 weeks now. And I feel like it has shifted. And now we are at a point where they are just no longer in it.
Yeah, I think I said last time that the Jays need to get out on like a 7-game win streak at some point in order to climb back to 500, get your head back above water and possibly position yourself to compete for the third wild card and be measured buyers at the deadline. And they've done the exact opposite of that since we last spoke. They actually lost 7 in a row, fell way further below 500. The Fangraphs playoff odds today right around 5%. So I think that's pretty representative. I'd say there is a 95% chance that this is not a postseason team.
Yeah, and Baseball Reference even lower on the Blue Jays. They're also dealing with some significant injuries, a significant suspension that we'll get to. So yeah, this is not even a team that's necessarily at full strength. And they're about to play the Yankees and the Astros. It's not an easy time. So I guess like as we're discussing this team, I tend to view them as sellers. Like to me, there's not necessarily a lot of nuance. And Ross Atkins, he's going to address the media later this afternoon on Thursday. I expect he's going to say that, hey, he wants to give this team every chance to compete. And there's no downside in saying something like that if you're the GM of the team, because it's not like trades happen on June the 28th or June the 29th anyway. So you can still, you know, let the season play out. But in my mind, it's no longer let the season play out and, hey, maybe they're actually going to turn this around. It's more so let the season play out and let the buyers come to you, let the offers come in with the expectation that the Blue Jays this summer are going to be sellers.
Yeah, there's just no sense in making any kind of like a firm determination at this time on June 27th. Like, just wait for a month. You know, all the action happens in those few days before the trade deadline for reasons, right? Like, that's, you know, the humans work to deadlines naturally, and baseball front offices in particular seem to take every last second that they can to gather information and let things play out. And there's going to be a lot of teams throughout July that are in that murky middle and aren't sure if they're strong buyers or hard sellers or cautious buyers or moderate sellers, maybe trying to do some sort of a hybrid of both. So yeah, there's no sense in even kind of like just saying you are one or the other right now. You just work quietly to build out your pref lists of prospects and even big leaguers and other organizations, and you start having some quiet conversations with executives from other teams about how they're posturing themselves and where their stance is, what they're looking for, what they might try to do. And you try to build your sense of the market and get as much information as you can going into that last week before the deadline, when things will start picking up in a real way and you need to be nimble and versatile, dynamic, and able to move in a bunch of different directions with a playing field that is going to be changing really rapidly.
Right. And to me, the different directions are sell a lot, sell a little, sell this and hold that. Like, those to me are just the directions. And I, of course, there is still that 5% chance, you know, if they roll off 10 in a row, we're having a different conversation, 10 wins, that is, we're having a different conversation. But the way things are right now, my personal belief is, and, you know, tell me if you disagree, but my personal belief is, as you're assigning these pro scouts, as you're assigning front office people within the organization to kind of survey and really understand who might be surplus to another team's roster, it has to be with the mindset and the priority of we are likely to be sellers.
Of course. Yeah.
So last week we talked about kind of where those thresholds would have to be to buy and to sell. And after we spoke, we kind of went back and forth a little bit. It was a discussion that for me prompted some other questions. So I asked some people with different teams about where they would have to be broadly to sort of buy or sell within that within those playoff odds and what that would have to look like for them to justify moving in one direction or the other. And I was a little surprised at how low some of these executives said it was reasonable to be as far as being a buyer. And they said, hey, if you're 25-30%, it's completely reasonable to be a buyer. Now, that is way, way ahead of where the Blue Jays are at right now. And in talking to some of those same executives, they were looking at the Blue Jays as a team that was likely to hold or even buy, even a week ago, like after we recorded our last podcast. But in the week since, things are shifting. And I'm hearing questions now from executives with other teams about the future of Ross Atkins. And is he going to be the long-term GM? We haven't heard from Mark Shapiro on Ross Atkins, but obviously fans have their opinion. I think that people in the game too are starting to look at this front office and say, is there a long-term future with this current front office? Or what is the big picture direction from ownership and from Mark Shapiro when it comes to who's making the baseball ops decisions around this team?
That's interesting. So like, do you think that that's a near-term consideration or are they thinking more longer term?
I think executives around the game just have the tendency to speculate about various front offices, right? So the Blue Jays aren't alone in this. I think that when you're looking at San Francisco Giants, even the Padres, you know, potentially the Cardinals, there are going to be questions around the front offices that are not meeting expectations. And I think with that, there comes a certain amount of speculation of, hey, like, are these front offices fully secure in their jobs? And for example, you know, Farhan Zaidi with the Giants, he's made some really high profile moves. He's spent big. He's missed big on some free agents and spent big on some free agents. That's a team that's under 500. There is going to be speculation around that. Now, ultimately, it's up to Giants ownership. It doesn't really matter what an executive thinks, you know, with another team, what the Giants are going to do or what the Blue Jays are going to do. But I do find that interesting to know that there is that sort of, there are those questions that are starting to emerge. And look, like, my assumption here is that Ross Atkins is going to be in this job throughout, you know, most of the 2024 season. I think the time that you see most GM changes is at the end of a season. And knowing that the Blue Jays value stability, knowing that Mark Shapiro is not someone to make rash decisions, I'm not sitting here expecting that the Blue Jays are going to make a GM change in this next couple weeks by any stretch, especially with the draft coming up and the trade deadline. It might be seen as disruptive to make that sort of a shift at this point midway through the season. But for me, it will be a huge question. It's the biggest question for Mark Shapiro to answer the next time he speaks publicly. And by the end of the year, I mean, we know this time last year or toward the end of last year, Mark Shapiro said that Ross Atkins had an undeniable resume as GM of the Blue Jays. And I'm not sure that it's undeniable anymore. Doesn't mean he won't continue to be the GM. Doesn't mean that the Blue Jays won't have better things happen in the second half. But I don't think it's undeniable. And so it is an interesting question to me as we discuss this team.
Yeah, that's why I'm kind of surprised to hear that speculation if it is in the near term. I understand it if it's in the long term, but if it's in like the next, you know, 5 to 6 weeks, I would be just shocked if the Blue Jays removed Ross Atkins from the GM role in the next 5 to 6 weeks. I mean, you've got a draft upcoming, you've got a deadline upcoming. You're going to put somebody else into like such an important decision-making role ahead of some incredibly important decisions when it comes to making selections at the draft and perhaps executing a soft sell-off. Or perhaps an even broader sell-off at the deadline in essentially a month's time. You know, I haven't seen anything from the Blue Jays organization of the last 9 years that would suggest that that is something that they would do. If they're going to consider something like that, I would expect it to be, you know, once you're past the draft, past the deadline, much later this season, likely prior to the beginning of the off season, which again is a time when you have some really big decisions that need to be made.
That's right. And that's, you know, that is speculation. We don't know exactly how this is going to unfold. It's believed that Ross Atkins is under contract for 2 more years beyond this year. So, you know, he is the GM. That is the expectation as the Blue Jays move ahead here, which leads to what scale of a sell-off do they take if they do indeed sell at the upcoming trade deadline in a month's time? And I think, you know, as I look at this, it's pretty clear. You've got your pending free agents like Yusei Kikuchi, Jimmy Garcia, Trevor Richards, Kiermaier, and Justin Turner. Those guys are about to hit free agency anyway. If this season is not the Blue Jays' year, I think that clearly those guys will be available and a number of them would likely be traded. The question becomes, how extensively do you listen, or how openly do you listen on players who are under team control beyond 2024?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on record. Like, I think that you absolutely have to try to return some value on anybody who's a pending free agent and healthy and productive enough to have some value. So, you know, there could be some question in terms of the production when it comes to guys like Kevin Kiermaier and Justin Turner. You know, Turner's bounced back in a really nice way from a pretty disastrous May. Kiermaier continues to have a pretty underwhelming season offensively, but he obviously brings a ton in a fourth outfield role as a defensive replacement and base runner. And just a veteran energy guy who you want around your club, a guy who's been to the postseason a number of times before.
Fastball hit in the air, right center field, long run, and Kiermaier makes the catch. Yoshida will tag and come to third, but a great play by Kiermaier to take extra base.
Justin Turner also checks that experience box, so I expect that even with the seasons that those guys had, that they would be coveted somewhere at the deadline. You're not getting a top 100 prospect back for those guys, obviously, but the Blue Jays can pay the freight on the rest of their salaries and at least get an interesting prospect to add to their system and just kind of build out their minor league depth a little bit. Yusei Kikuchi and Jimmy Garcia obviously could bring back some of the better returns there. I mean, Kikuchi likely one of the better starting pitchers who's available. Jimmy Garcia could, like, you know, the Semro Bersa and Adam Kloffenstein trade last year. I am fresh off a flight this morning. My brain is not working
full
right
disclosure.
Now.
Arden was on the full road trip, Cleveland and Boston. It's been a busy week, but your mind is full of facts. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I was like, what? Who did they trade for Jordan Hicks? Right, Roberta and Kloffenstein. So, like, that to me, that's like a decent comp for Garcia. You could look to do something similar to that at the deadline there. So, yeah, and then beyond that, I mean, I just think you have too many holes to fill for next year to want to create more holes by trading from your starting staff or trading anybody, you know, like certainly not a Bo Bichette or a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. I'd be really surprised if either of those guys were moved. As it stands, the Blue Jays have a ton of offseason work to do ahead of 2025 when I think they will and they should and they ought to be trying to contend if they're running a similar payroll to the one that they ran this year and if they're keeping the general structure of this roster intact. So I think it would likely just be the pending free agents.
Yeah, I think that that's a safe default. And I want to touch on the 2025 question because I think it's tempting on the part of anyone who's watched this team this year, whether it be fans or media, maybe even some within the actual Toronto Blue Jays orbit who work for the team. But it can be tempting to look at this group and say, they're cooked. There's no chance they're going to win even in 2025 because look at them. Have you not seen what's happened on the field? They are not good enough. And I feel that because it's been such an underwhelming season basically from, you know, the first month onward where they've been under 500 every single month of the season, never really put together a big run, constant disappointment. But again, this is a sport where not only did the Diamondbacks make the World Series after an 84 win season last year, the Marlins made the playoffs last year. Like, you don't have to be that good. And I don't think the Blue Jays are going to be a 100-win team in 2025. I don't think that they're going to be one of the best teams in baseball. But hey, I do think they could be a wildcard team with the right additions next year. So to me, that's something to strive for. And it might seem like an unambitious goal, but to me, it beats the alternative of punting on a season that's still 82 games and 8 months away.
If you're spending $200 million on payroll and you're building around a roster that has Bo Bichette, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Jose Berrios, Chris Bassett, Kevin Gausman on it, and you have really useful supporting players such as Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, and honestly, like, Dalton Varsho is actually a core player. I shouldn't put him in the supporting cast. He should have been in the prior group that I mentioned.
And Dalton gets one high in the air to deep right. Dalton Varsho with a grand slam, and it is 6-2 for the Blue Jays.
But, you know, supporting cast players like Spencer Horwitz, Davis Schneider, you know, Jordan Romano should be back and healthy next year. Maybe you get some other good stories in the bullpen coming out of the minor league system. Like, you have a good structure. You have good bones there. You have a bunch of money coming off the books. You can go out into free agency and spend and get a bunch of veterans on shorter term deals, which is something that the Blue Jays have done well in the past. Obviously, hasn't worked out incredibly this year with Justin Turner and Kevin Kiermaier, but there is a track record there of the Blue Jays making pretty good bets on short term deals for veterans in free agency. So they can build out that way, maybe find a trade or two that, you know, to their liking this offseason, and I think pretty easily construct a roster that ought to contend for the third or second wildcard spot in 2025.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like an achievable goal. So that's where, all right, you're probably holding Vlad and Bo because those guys help you win. And you're probably holding Gausman and Bassett and Chad Green as well. I will say, I would listen on those pitchers if I were the Jays. I think that if you can get, and it would have to probably be for pitching coming back. I mean, obviously, if you're trading Bassett or Gausman, you have to be getting pitching back in that deal. But I would listen. I would listen on those guys. And it would take a high price, would not be eager to move them. But I think in the spirit of being as creative as possible and trying to set this team up long term, I think it's something that's worth considering.
Yeah, the Blue Jays have a value on each of their players, and they will have a, you know, they will be able to place a value on any kind of offers that they receive. So they're constantly listening on everyone, because if you get a trade where the value you are bringing in just so far exceeds the value of the player that you have to really seriously consider that just for the, you know, long-term sustainability of winning as a franchise. So yeah, the Blue Jays are always listening on everybody. Nobody's ever untouchable. If you get blown away in, you know, the value department, you're going to have a very serious conversation about it. But I am really not expecting any of those people that you mentioned to be traded this deadline. I think it will likely just be the pending free agents.
I think that is the safe bet. But yeah, like you said, no one's untouchable. And I think that, you know, technically speaking, that might have been true 2 years ago, but I think it's way more true now, where, you know, Vladdy, Bo, they're not untouchable anymore. And there was obviously a time that those guys were just franchise cornerstones. I still think that, you know, especially the way Vladdy's been hitting the last few days offers a reminder of what he looks like when he's hitting for power. There's an extension discussion to be had there at some point. But yeah, I think at this point, you got to be open-minded. And I would agree with your conclusion that it's likely we're talking about the pending free agents. So we will take a break then. Step aside for a moment here on At the Letters, and when we come back, we will discuss some of those more granular questions around this team. Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. All right, we're back on At the Letters, and having discussed the not-so-promising big-picture outlook for this team, I mean, that's putting it mildly, it's a bad outlook for 2024. For the Blue Jays, but let's dive in to some of the details here on this ball club, including Aurelvis Martinez, Vlad Jr., where he's at, Bo Bichette back from the injured list, what it means for George Springer to be in this situation and where the Blue Jays go with him going forward. And we'll touch on some of the injured players as well here. Arden, let's start with Aurelvis Martinez. He says that he and his girlfriend were trying to start a family and that he took a substance that he didn't realize was banned. And now he will be suspended for 80 games. Yeah, this is really bad for the Blue Jays developmentally and for their medium and long term, because you want your best young players to play. You don't want them on the sidelines because they were not careful enough to take substances that are approved and allowed by Major League Baseball.
I think it's just an enormous blow for the Blue Jays, honestly. Like, when you think about, this is your top hitting prospect, or at least your closest to the big leagues. Like, if you want to make an argument that Arjun Damala is a more promising prospect, like, that's fine. But Aurelvis Martinez is somebody that you really could have dreamed on helping the Blue Jays in a substantial way later this season. Like, he'd actually already been called up. And, you know, I don't know that the Blue Jays call him up when they did, if Leo Jimenez hadn't just come off of the concussion IL at the time. But like, I don't even know that I can like describe for you being there, like the juxtaposition of him having his first game in the big leagues, getting his first hit, like just the joy that he showed. We're in the like the bowels of Progressive Field there in Cleveland, and I'm seeing him hug his parents and give them the ball, and he's got all kinds of family there that have come in from the Dominican Republic to be there with him for the occasion, and like his teammates are so fired up for him. Like, he's just like, it was just a really kind of warm, supportive scene. And then 24 hours later, he's been suspended 80 games for popping for a PED. And it's just like such a 180. And as you mentioned, like, you lose not only the developmental experience that he would have had of playing games either in the minors or the big leagues for the next 80 games. The Blue Jays lose somebody who could have really like helped them win over the next however many games he's going to be up here in the big leagues for the rest of the year. They lose a chance to further evaluate him as a player. He loses opportunities to improve defensively. Like, I don't care how many, you know, little ground balls you get hit off a coach's fungo bat on a, you know, during an infield drill. It's just not the same as the speed of an MLB game and the read of a live ball off a bat. Like, those are the experiences that Aurelvis Martinez needs to be getting right now in order to improve defensively and find a defensive home where he can play going forward. So he's not just this 22-year-old DH. And this is a Blue Jays team that has needed power all year, that has needed help in the home run department. And Aurelvis Martinez is somebody who leads the minor leagues in home runs since 2021. So this was just like, to me, like a massive blow to the Blue Jays that Aurelvis Martinez has been suspended for the next 80 games.
Yeah, a poor judgment on his part, no question, to be taking substances that are banned because they are too... they enhance performance too much. So yeah, very poor judgment on his part. He pays the price. He will not play again this season. And like you said, the Blue Jays pay a big price here. I think, you know, next year, as a result of this, you go into spring training 2025, and you kind of don't know what you have still. Whereas someone like Spencer Horwitz, someone like Addison Barger, in the course of the next 3 months, they will likely get enough reps that the Blue Jays will have a pretty reasonable idea of what they can expect. And then that informs their offseason. And do they need to add two bats or three bats? Or, you know, what does that look like? Where Martinez remains this unknown, both defensively and offensively. So it also creates this information vacuum that makes it harder for the Blue Jays to move ahead.
Oh, totally. And just what is going to be the fallout of this for him mentally, like for his psyche, for his confidence going forward? Like, I'm sure this has been a rattling experience for him going through everything that he did in Cleveland and having that 180 that I just described. It's not impossible that he, you know, just cruises past this and comes back and picks up where he left off and goes on to have a great MLB career, right? I mean, Emmanuel Clase had a PED suspension, Jorge Polanco, Fernando Tatis, like there's a, you know, Frankie Montas. I mean, there's a lot of players who were able to get past this and go on to have really productive big league careers, but there, like you said, there is now uncertainty as to how he's going to fit going forward, what he's going to look like when he comes back, how much more the Blue Jays will need to see from him in the minors. Like, this is somebody who could have been like an opening day roster 2025 piece. Like, this is one of those, we've been talking so much about how they need more upward pressure on this roster. Like, they need more developmental success stories. They need some more pre-arb players filling in with everyday roles and providing above league average production so that the Blue Jays can go out and have more resources to bring in veterans in free agency to fill in the gaps around them. Like, the Blue Jays need to start replenishing the talent on their roster at some point with younger players. And Aurelvis Martinez was as well positioned as anyone to do that and had as much upside as any prospect that you're going to see with the Blue Jays in the next 12 months. And now this PED suspension just throws all of that into question.
It does. And it's been a rough year for the Blue Jays farm system. I mean, you look at a farm system that started the season objectively ranked 20, 21, 22 by outlets like ESPN, MLB.com, and Baseball America. So objectively a below average farm system. Then all right, Aurelvis Martinez suspended for half the year. You've got injuries to players like Landon Marudas and Brandon Barriera and Ricky Tiedemann. That creates setbacks amongst some of your top pitching prospects. You do have an Adam Macko who's taken steps forward. Maybe we see him in the major leagues in the second half of this season. But as long as we're talking prospects here, let's hear the latest on Ricky Tiedemann, because he was able to get back into a minor league rehab game recently. And that's a big one for the Blue Jays. Again, not only in the short term, because he could debut in the majors this year, but more importantly, for the long term.
He lifts and deals. Swing and a miss. Strike three. And Tiedemann picks up three strikeouts in the second inning.
Yeah, 100%. I think we will see Ricky Tiedemann in the majors at some point this year. And, like, unfortunately, it's just going to be very likely a late season. Hey, here's a nice story. Here's a prospect coming up while the Blue Jays are out of it and giving opportunities to young players. And maybe some of the veteran starters in the rotation have actually been shut down later in the season to kind of just save some bullets for next year. But look, Tiedemann's going to continue building up workload over his next few outings. He started for Dunedin on Wednesday and is just continuing to like up that pitch count. The Blue Jays want to get him up around 85-90, and they want to get him on that regular starters routine back with the Buffalo Bisons. And from there, like, if he can be pitch efficient, if he can limit walks, attack with his fastball, slider, and change up, he could be in the majors rather quickly in the second half, I think. Like, I don't think he would have to show that much for the Blue Jays to give an opportunity in the big leagues. So the big thing for him is that, and he's admitted this, he's been a little bit more thrower than pitcher at times this year, and he's just been trying to outstuff hitters, and that's led to some of the walks, and that's led to some of the pitch inefficiency and the 1-0s, the 2-1s, the 3-1 counts. So the Blue Jays want to see him just executing his pitches a lot more purposefully rather than just trying to blow everything past hitters. But yeah, if Tiedemann is healthy and effective, like, I don't think it'll be that long before we see him at the big league level.
That's a good thing for Ricky Tiedemann, certainly, and potentially for the Blue Jays.
Can I give one more like pseudo prospect take here? And he's not really a prospect anymore, but Spencer Horwitz is a big leaguer. And he has been just so impressive since he's been called up. Like, you look at just the professionalism of his approach, how advanced it is, how patient he is, what a good idea he has of what he's doing at the plate. And a lot of that stuff, like, we knew this guy could make really good swing decisions. So we knew that he could run like a pretty low chase rate. But the thing that has been really impressive, like, so far in this stint in the big leagues is the barrel control and the contact ability. And that's not something that we necessarily saw from him in his brief stage in the big leagues last year. Last year when he was up, his whiff rate was up around 30%. The ground ball rate was like 65%. The barrel rate was only around 7. So, like, those aren't great numbers. But so far this year, he's cut like 15 points off that whiff rate down to around 14%. The ground ball rate, he's decreased by over 26 points. The barrel rate has gone up 6%. So the way to think about that is he's making much more contact. He's making much more contact in the air, and he's making much harder contact. Like, this is exactly what you want to see. If you layer that in with the selectivity and the understanding of how to manage a strike zone and what a pitcher's trying to do to him, he could be a really useful player for the Blue Jays, particularly if he's playing a capable second base. Like, there's always been questions about whether he'd show enough power to be like a big league first baseman. But if he's going to be a second baseman and like playable defensively there, all of a sudden, like, his hit profile looks really, really good. He looks like a super valuable piece to have. Probably should have been up earlier in the season, now that you think of it. But like, I just, you know, I look back to the plate appearance against Tristan McKenzie in Cleveland. I want to say, I think it was on Sunday, and Horwitz in like his first plate appearance against McKenzie, who is just like uber tall on the mound, right? He's like 6'5", and he comes from this like really high release point. So this like this curveball is just like dropping off of a skyscraper. And speaking to Horwitz, he's like, well, I'd never seen him before, right? So I just wanted to kind of get a feel for what that looked like, what that felt like in his first plate appearance. And once he did, and once he realized he could kind of recognize that curveball out of hand, he realized like, oh, hey, I've been kind of swinging a little too flat to be able to like make my best contact with this, I need to change like my plane and change my bat path. So he actually, in his second plate appearance, went up with the intention to, hey, I'm going to be more vertical. Like I'm actually going to turn my bat down a little bit, make a little bit of an adjustment. Bang.
Swing and a fly ball down the right field line. That one's deep. It's off the foul pole for a home run. First of the season by Spencer Horwitz. Second Blue Jays home run of the day.
He hits a home run off the right field foul pole because of that adjustment. And I think that just demonstrates like how he's able to manipulate his bat head a lot better than I think people give him credit for. And the ability to like plate appearance, find a way to make better contact and to make adjustments to pitchers and to not make the same out 1, 2, 3 times against an opposition starter. And then obviously I don't need to tell anybody about what he did against Emmanuel Clase. I think it was later in that game. Yeah, it was in that same game where he had like a 12-pitch plate appearance against Clase. He goes down 0-2. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has a one pitch out against Class A for the first out of that ninth inning. So now Spencer Horwitz is coming up and he's like, well, I got to take the first pitch because I'm not making another out first pitch. He goes 0-1 and then he's 0-2. And 10 pitches later, he's taking a walk after fouling off like 102 mile per hour cutters in on his hands and laying off like 90 mile per hour sliders just off the outside edge. Like that was just such an impressive plate appearance. The longest plate appearance by pitches of Emmanuel Clase's career. We're talking about like one of the best, if not the best closer in the game. I just could not be more impressed with what I've seen from Spencer Horwitz at the plate and the way that he's really rounded out his offensive game.
He's been really good. You look at more walks than strikeouts this year, 11 walks to 6 strikeouts, showing off the power, as you mentioned, and contributing at second base too. I mean, that's a huge advantage for the Blue Jays if they can use him at second base as well as first base. Now, you look at, it's only been 15 games, but it's been great for Horwitz. Is he the best story on the Blue Jays this season? Like, is there a better story than Spencer Horwitz?
I think Davis Schneider's first half was a pretty good story. And now I think in the second half, like Spencer Horwitz has to be the best story. Like you could argue, hey, the way that Jose Berríos started the year, like that was a pretty good story. Not so good recently. And kind of the inverse of that with Chris Bassitt, where you look at the run where he's on over the last like 6, 7, 8 starts. I mean, it's kind of like sneaky all-star bid being put together by Chris Bassitt right now. I don't know if he'll get there, but he might be deserving when you actually measure up his innings pitched, his ERA, his results against others in the American League, just considering what he's done lately. I think Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has been a really good story. I mean, that's been a really useful guy. So many people around the Blue Jays were just so complimentary of the way that Kiner-Falefa stepped in for Bo Bichette while he was out for 10 days, and the way that he kind of took control of the infield was like quarterbacking things. Talking to John Schneider, he was telling me like he would go out to make pitching changes and Kiner-Falefa would be like on the mound going over like strategy with him during a pitching change, and like, hey, you know, if it's hit over here, like let's play this way and I'm gonna go home, or let's actually line up over there. And Schneider's like, dude, you are 3 steps ahead of like what we're even thinking about in the dugout right now. He was just like super engaged and really took on a leadership role without Bo there, and I think that kind of went under the radar a little bit and unnoticed. While Bo was out, Kiner-Falefa played every single inning at shortstop, handled every ball hit at him, and has been giving the Blue Jays, I think, way more than they could have expected offensively as well. So that's another good story that I would point to that I think goes a little bit under the radar.
2.8 WAR for Isaiah Kiner-Falefa so far this year. It's been a great pickup, no question about that. And yeah, I mean, Vladdy's been really good. It's funny you mentioned all-star bid for Chris Bassitt. I did a quick scan of the Blue Jays roster, kind of thinking like, who's going to be their all-star? I think Vladdy will make it. I think he deserves to make it. I don't necessarily see, I mean, Varsho could be another one. IKF, it's going to be tough. It's going to be an uphill battle for him just because utility players, you know, it's tends to be a tougher path to that kind of recognition. But yeah, either way, the Jays have some players performing well, not enough of them, but they do have some players performing well. And as for IKF, anytime that you play shortstop in the major leagues and no one's noticing you, that is a good thing. That is a compliment because it is a tough position. You are tested in lots of different ways all the time. It's easy to mess up out there, and he held his own. But now Bo Bichette is back, and that for the Blue Jays is really important. As much as Bichette has struggled at the plate this season, he's so important to everything they do out there. So what's your sense of where Bo Bichette is at mechanically, mentally, as he returns?
Yeah, it was interesting. I caught up with Bo the other day when he was about to come off of the IL, and like Bo didn't even want to go on the IL. He kind of had to be pushed there because the Blue Jays wanted to be really cautious with him. He actually picked up this injury the first game the Blue Jays were in Milwaukee. There was like a Willie Adames slow roller, and you know, Bo had to really arrange for it and just kind of felt something in his calf. And then he played through it for like a number of days, and he was telling me like he felt it every step he took in the field, like everything that he did. And you go back, you look at those games, like he's still making all the plays. He's actually coming up with a bunch of hits at the plate. Like you wouldn't have noticed in the standard of play, but like he was just feeling this thing every step he took, and it was getting worse. So, you know, he thought that maybe with just a few days off, he could have been better. The Blue Jays ended up ILing him. He was ready to come back like 7 days into his IL stint. He's ready to go. He was kind of telling me like one of the things he really noticed while he was on the bench watching his teammates was just the way that like the energy kind of waxed and waned throughout games. And remember when Bo was out, like the Jays are on this 7-game losing streak, and they're losing a lot of these games in really dispiriting fashion, whether it's like the, you know, Cleveland Guardians hitting a million home runs against them, whether it was the last game of that 7-game losing streak in Boston when the Blue Jays had like a 98% win probability in the eighth inning, right? They were up 6-2 going into the bottom of the eighth, and you know, just everything that could go wrong does go wrong in that inning. Had, you know, a pretty veteran Blue Jay tell me that that was one of the worst losses that they've witnessed of their career, just considering the context of everything that went into it. So like Bo's watching all this, and he said he really did notice how like the energy would lapse on the field at times, and he said he wants to come back and like bring some more of that energy himself and force some of that and make sure that like his energy is super consistent. So I thought that was interesting. And also he, you know, I kind of asked him like, yeah, have you been doing anything with the swing, or do you kind of look into anything with the mechanics? Were you able to sort of reset while you're off? And he told me no. And he said, I actually feel like I'm swinging it as well as I have all season. I think I'm just a tick off. And Bo has been just a tick off all year when you look at the barrel rate, right? Like the contact is the same, the strikeout to walk, the chase, like all that stuff lines up. It really just has been like getting the barrel to the ball consistently, getting that sweet spot, making that quality of contact that Bo can. So if he finds that tick, it is possible that he goes on one of these like insane runs that we've seen from him before. It's just about finding that tick. But figuring out Bo Bichette going into next year, I think is a really high leverage thing for the Blue Jays, because like when he's at his best, like this is somebody who can carry an offense just like Vlad has been carrying the Blue Jays offense of recently. And if they could get both those two guys going at once, I think a lot of people would feel a lot better about the Blue Jays for 2025.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are huge, hugely important players for this team right now and next year. Part of the reason that I think the safe bet is that they are not traded is that they are really good players, and the Blue Jays don't have enough of those. They need to be adding offense, not subtracting it for next year. So, you know, that makes sense on Bo Bichette. I completely agree that this is still a player that, you know, we're looking at a guy who has established himself year over year as a really, really high level hitter. You look at some of the underlying metrics and they're not good, but they aren't completely worrying in the same way that they are for George Springer, where for Springer, the underlying metrics reflect a true decline in skill and performance. And to me, this is extremely, extremely worrying if you're the Toronto Blue Jays, despite the home run that he hit at Fenway Park the other day on a slider over the middle of the plate, which great, good for him. That's what he should do with that pitch. But with Bo Bichette, you're talking about someone who should still be in his prime. I still don't read this as a, you know, decline by Bo Bichette. I read this as man, that was a rough 3 months. And he's probably going to go out in OPS 780 and hit 290 the rest of the way. And that's a really good player. That's someone who the Jays will obviously be thrilled to pencil in there somewhere in the top of the order. But in the meantime, they do have Vlad Jr. producing not only with the walks and the singles and the doubles, but actually finding the power stroke. So this is a huge development for them. Obviously, he's got 10 home runs on the year, on pace for 20. Still not massive power numbers, but it's been ticking up lately, and that's a really good thing for this team.
Yeah, he's made a little bit of an adjustment just to get the swing started a little sooner, get that front foot down like a little bit more in time, I guess, with the pitcher earlier in their delivery. I'm by no means like a hitting mechanics expert, but you know, that's what I was told. And obviously people always talk about the hands with Vlad as well, and just kind of being quiet with the hands. I think you're seeing those two things working in concert for him at the plate right now, and he is just in such a rhythm. He's just so calm and everything is so fluid at the plate, and I think that's really helping him get around on velocity a lot better. You know, like we've been talking all year about Vlad's search for power, but I feel like we haven't talked enough about Vlad's performance against power. You look at 21 through 23, so the last 3 years, and against pitches 97 plus, Vlad was hitting 325, like a 485 slug, like a big barrel rate, average exit velo up over 91 miles per hour. But then this season, entering Tuesday, he was hitting 083 with a 083 slug against 97 plus miles per hour. He had only two singles against fastballs 97 plus miles per hour, and he had seen well over 100 of them. The average exit velo was below 90. He hadn't barreled one of those pitches yet. But then he makes some of these adjustments, and he goes out on Tuesday. He's facing Brian Baio. Brian Baio is trying to do to Vlad what everyone tries to do to Vlad. He's trying to bust him inside with velocity and go soft away with his off-speed stuff, trying to get Vlad to chase that stuff away, trying to get him to jam himself inside. And Vlad just does a really nice job of being disciplined, being patient, not chasing, not expanding, not deciding he's going to swing before the pitcher is even delivered. Gets himself into a 3-1 count, forces Baio onto the plate, and then gets around on one of those 97 mile per hour pitches. It was a 97 mile per hour sinker from Baio, and Vlad hits it into the center field triangle at Fenway Park. Probably would have been a homer. Hit a bunch of parks. It was his fourth ball that he hit 400 feet or further in the span of 3 days. And it's a two-run double. And I think that's just like such a good sign for him to finally get around on velo again and to get his first extra base hit of the year against a pitch 97 miles per hour or harder. I think that that's huge for him. And I think that some of those adjustments, some of the ability to get more lift on the ball, to continue hitting the ball hard, like 9 of his last 12 balls in play are 100 miles per hour or harder, but that's also resulted in 6 extra base hits. Like, we're not talking about really hard ground ball singles. You know, we're talking about now doubles and homers, including the longest homer of his career, which he hit into a friggin' parking garage over the Green Monster in Boston. So I, you know, if Vlad can maintain some of these adjustments, just stay where he's at right now, I think the power is going to start showing back up. And Vlad can just get back to being, you know, I don't know that we'll ever see 2021 Vlad ever again, but 2022 Vlad was pretty damn good, and that's what he's looked like lately.
And Vladdy launches one. Deep left field and gone. It disappears into the Boston night. A booming three-run homer.
Yeah, I think 2024 Vlad is pretty good. Like, playing a little third for you, playing the good first base, you know, with certain notable pop-ups accepted, although that was George Springer's ball. But in any case, this version of Vladdy, it's good. He's a good player. Offense is down too, right? I mean, I know you know this, but just as a reminder for anyone listening, league OPS is like 695. I'll look it up right now, but it is low. So for Vladdy to be doing what he's doing, 30% better than league average, playing every single day in a league context where, yeah, the OPS is 704, he's having a really good year. And it's interesting when you talk about power, right? Because he has power. And so it's really a question of, is he accessing the power. It's not does he have it. It's always been there ever since he's been a kid, like 15, 16 years old. He was making incredible contact off the bat. So it's a question of, as you said, is he able to get under the ball, hit it on an angle to the point that it's going up and over outfielders' heads and into the seats, as opposed to down and into the ground. And great, you have a single to left field. Better than nothing, but you know, not really the high end upside for Vladdy. So, you know, I think when you look at what he's doing lately, what he's done this year, where he's at in his career at 25 years old, I definitely won't be surprised if he hits 15 the rest of the way, finishes with, you know, 25 homers, well above average OPS, plays every day, 100 RBI. I mean, he's having a good year, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's funny. We titled a recent episode, Let the Kids Play, right? And it was what we were talking about. Yeah, get Davis Schneider in there regularly and get Spoetzer Horowitz in there more often. Vlad's younger than these guys. Like the Buffalo boys, Vlad's younger than them. So you want to let the kids play. You want to let Vlad play the way he is lately. He's got 5 homers in June, which matches his combined total from April and May, which says one thing about how good he's been in June and another about how absent the power was in April and May. The average exit velo this month, by the way, the highest of any month in his career, which is wild considering the fact that Vlad has always hit the ball hard, even when he wasn't seeing the results, even when it was just ground balls or lined right at people or whatever, even when that launch angle wasn't there, he's always hit the ball hard. But he's averaging 97 miles per hour off the bat this month, which is ridiculous. And the 5.11 slug so far this month is his highest since August 2022. So
that's good. That's right. I'm sure the Mariners pro scouts must love it. Padres special advisors must love it. What, you think they don't? You think they don't love it? Of course they do.
No, I think he's going to play for the Red Sox because how do you not throw all the money at Vlad free agency if you're the Red Sox? This guy at Fenway Park. So since Vlad came into the big leagues in 2019, among the many, many, many players who have made at least 100 plate appearances at Fenway since 2019, Vlad is first in average, first in OBP, first in slugging, first in WRC plus. He's played 41 games at Fenway and he has 41 driven in that course. He's hitting 350 at Fenway with like a 1050 OPS, and he plays at Fenway a lot. So if you're the Red Sox, you need to throw all of the money at Vladimir Guerrero Jr. whenever you can.
If you're the Yankees, you should try to acquire him this year. Rizzo on the 60-day IL. Imagine. Honestly, they should. They should.
Could you imagine?
Vladdy and Stroh, Stanton and Judge. And I don't know, I'm sure you heard of the comments that Vladdy made to a Spanish language reporter at Fenway Park this week, where he softened his stance a little bit, speaking in Spanish about the possibility of playing for the Yankees, a team that he once said he would not play for, not even dead. So sounds like he had a conversation with his dad and, you know, hey, he's going to play where he has to play. And obviously at this point, he doesn't have a choice. And he says he's happy to be with the Blue Jays. And I believe that. And I think a lot of this is, you know, it's entertainment. It's the entertainment side of the game, which is here to for fun and to entertain us. And part of that is these different possibilities. But yeah, I mean, look, he's a really, really good player. And let's not forget that when I know you don't forget that. But, you know, listen to anyone listening. Let's not forget that when we're talking about this team. Vladdy's really good.
Yeah, you know, if you're dead, I don't think you're playing for any teams because I think you're dead. But yeah, for sure. No, Vlad, I think what he said in that interview was it's a business, and I could not agree more. I think that was the most prescient thing that he said there, and I'm sure that's what he's come around to. Can I make one point on George Springer before we go here? Because
that's where I was going next.
Oh,
yeah,
okay,
I want to go to George Springer. So, all right, let's, you know, we talk about underlying stats, right? Because Vladdy, he's hitting the ball hard. Bo Bichette's even got some, you know, some indicators that aren't so bad. Spencer Horowitz, of course, it looks good behind the curtain. In contrast to that, we have George Springer. And I'll answer the question before I set up the little preamble here, or I'll ask the question. The question is, what should the Blue Jays do with George Springer at this point? But I'll give you a little preamble as far as some of the advanced numbers. Barrel rate has dropped off in 3 consecutive seasons, now at a career low. Exit velocity as a maximum continues to drop off. This is a career low when it comes to max exit velocity. This is a career low when it comes to average exit velocity. This is a career low when it comes to expected weighted on base percentage. And it is also a career low when it comes to hard hit percentage. So George Springer is, and this will surprise nobody, but he is having behind the curtain, objectively, one of his worst seasons ever by far, and one of the worst offensive seasons of any player in Major League Baseball this season. Pitchers see it. They aren't scared of him. They are attacking him in ways that they haven't before. And so, yeah. So what should the Blue Jays do here?
It's a really funny situation where, like, I actually agree with the Blue Jays when they say they have numbers that suggest that he should be performing better this year, because, like, you look at, you know, the 291 slug against fastballs this year. Well, his expected slug against fastballs is 402. You look at the 350 slug against off speed this year, the expected slug is 520. So, like, I actually agree with them on that point. His expected batting average on any pitch, fastball, breaking ball, off speed, they're all higher than his actual. But at a certain point, it's a results business. At a certain point, it's about what you are actually doing on the field. And at a certain point, like, it's going to be impossible for him to overcome the craters that he's dug for himself in terms of, like, just where his batting average on base and slugging are at, even in the context of him perhaps deserving better outcomes. The funny thing is, as this Blue Jays season shifts from, hey, we're going to make a run at the third wild card, like, hey, we're going to buy and try to get into this, to where it seems this is going, where the Blue Jays sell and spend their final 2 months in evaluation mode, the thought around George Springer's playing time no longer goes from, wow, this is a guy who they should really only be playing like 3, 4, max 5 times a week, like, he's just he's really hurting you in your lineup right now and hurting your competitiveness, to this is a guy who needs to play as often as possible for the rest of the season, not only so that, like, he can continue trying to work out of this thing and trying to find the swing and find the rhythm that he needs to get back to something close to what he's been in his career. So it's not just this, like, off a cliff decline, but more so of a gradual decline, which should be expected as he gets into his mid-30s as an outfielder, but also so the Blue Jays can further evaluate him and know what they have in him going into 2025, what kind of role he could play for them in 2025, and what else they might have to do around him on their roster, just depending on where he's at. So it's a situation where you actually really want to see a lot more of George Springer for the rest of the year if you are the Blue Jays.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's interesting. I mean, maybe we should title this episode Let the Old Guys Play, because this is, you know, it's kind of flipped, right? Like, yeah. I agree. I agree 100%. I was thinking the same thing this week because, yeah, you got to figure out what you have. You got to get them right. The wins and losses, I mean, sorry to say it, but it doesn't really matter if they finish 74-88 versus 76-86. Like, it just, sorry to say it, just doesn't really matter. So you have bigger picture questions. You have to gather information for next year. Now, as to the point about, hey, there's some underlying numbers here, I think that's technically true, and you just pointed to some of them. At the same time, I am so unconvinced by that argument. Like, the guy is, I am so, so unconvinced by that. And, like, again, technically it's true, but the guy has 6 home runs. He plays every day. The numbers at a certain point, like, yeah, he has been unlucky as opposed to lucky when it comes to his batted balls, but we're not talking about a tiny sample anymore. He's on pace for 12 homers as a corner outfielder. Like, I'm sorry. He's having a bad offensive year. There's no splitting hairs here. It's just bad. And anyone who tries to say, you know, John Schneider can sit there, and I understand why John Schneider does it. It's his job. He wants to have Springer's back. But he tries to say, oh, yeah, it's actually a bit better. It's horrible. This has been one of the worst offensive seasons of any Blue Jay in years. It's one of the worst offensive seasons of anyone in Major League Baseball. Could it be a little better? Yes. And should it be? Yes. But he's still on pace for 12 homers.
For sure. I think, like, that is true, and it is also true that there is 50 points of difference between his weighted on base and his expected weighted on base, and the expected being 50 points higher than the actual. So, like, I think both things can be true, right? Like, it's not an either or, you know? Yeah. I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
Yeah, he has been having a bad season. He has also experienced some poor luck. When I'm thinking about George Springer's season, to me, it's more so he's just having a bad season. It's less so, oh, it's because he's been unlucky. But that's for everyone to decide where they place it on that spectrum.
I will say, like, there was quite a bit of relief when George Springer hit that home run at Fenway the other night.
Like that. That's what I mean by cheap.
This is deep. This is gone! Springer hits it out into the Red Sox bullpen.
Like, I have a great seat. I'm right beside the dugout. I see the reaction that George is getting. Matt Haig is giving him, like, an enormous hug. There was a bit of an attempt in the Blue Jays dugout to get a silent treatment for him, which would have been hilarious to see. They didn't get organized in time. But, there was at least an attempt to give him that. George himself was, like, he wears his heart on his sleeve, right? So he wasn't doing anything to not show his emotions and his relief in that moment, because it's hard to go through what he's been going through. This is a competitor. This is a guy who wants to do well. He doesn't want to go, he doesn't want to take the field every night and hit 198 or whatever it is. He doesn't want to come up to bat at Rogers Center and see that 198 looking at him from the Jumbotron. And, like, he knows how much he makes. He knows how important he is to this team. He wants to succeed. And I thought, like, it was cool as well in Fenway that, after that play in shallow right field, the Blue Jays defense, by the way, like, I think it's 11 errors over the last 8 games. By virtue of playing a lot of players out of position, they've got, like, multiple guys in the lineup every night who are playing positions that they learned in, like, the last year and a half. By virtue of just trying to force as much offense onto this roster as possible, the Blue Jays have sacrificed a lot defensively, and they have felt that compromise in a big way lately with some really shoddy defensive play that needs to be cleaned up. But you think about that play with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at Fenway Park. He's backpedaling on, I think it was a Tyler O'Neill pop-up, at first base, backpedaling to right, backpedaling, and just takes a spill and stays down, and it looks terrible. And I think you could point to, hey, you're a big league first baseman, you got to make that play. That's fine. Talking to George Springer after the game, like, he took full ownership of that play and said, I let Vladdy down there. Like, that's on me. I should know better. I've played here a million times before. I know the ball drifts towards right field here. I should have called him off. When I saw him backpedaling, I should have said that, but that's mine. I got it. Vlad, peel off. And George just said, that ball's on me. That's not going to happen again. So, like, yeah. I think that, for him to come out and say that, he didn't have to say that. And he did. So I think that speaks to, how he is in this with this team right now, despite his struggles.
Well, that's right. And look, I mean, there are some good teammates on this team. There are some, I get this question a lot. You probably do too, but people ask me, is there a chemistry problem? And I really don't think that's the case. I think these guys get along. They want to win. They try hard. They're showing up. They're doing their best. Just is not working, has not worked. And here they are. To me, it's not a question of, intensity, effort. I don't think these guys hate each other. Chemistry is always better when you win. But just hasn't been the case. And I just wanted to touch on one other thing you said there, which is the feeling of relief when George Springer hit a home run. And I got to say, that's so damning in its own way. Because, like, when you have, like, Bryce Harper hit a home run, his teammates aren't relieved. When Mookie Betts goes yard, his teammates are like, yep, that's Mookie. He's doing his thing. Normal. And for George Springer, his teammates are relieved. I mean, it's speaks to the season that they've had where they're like, oh, nice. George doesn't have to feel so bad about himself.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron Judge feels relief like every other night, He's felt relief like 30 times this year.
Exactly. When Aaron Judge goes deep, is Oswaldo Peraza sitting there being like, oh, thank goodness Aaron doesn't have to beat himself up. Like, I think they're fine. Oh, it's...
Problem for the Jays, they got a lot of guys who are feeling relief, right? You look at Danny Jansen lately, it's been quiet, but, like, this is a guy who's been slumping significantly. Kevin Kiermaier had a few hits in Boston and was like, yep, finally, like, came up against a breaking ball and got my bat timed up with it. Like, it was interesting looking at, like, Kiermaier, Jansen, Springer in particular, like, how many breaking balls they were seeing during those slumps. Like, these guys are all seeing over 40% breaking balls, which, like, that's within, like, the top 10% of MLB hitters over their slumps, and they were struggling against them. They all had, like, batting averages and slugging percentages, you know, plus or minus 100 on either side of that. And you can figure out why, right? Danny Jansen's got a pretty one-dimensional approach. He's told everybody, I'm trying to pull heaters to left field and trying to pull everything to left. And pitchers saying, okay, we're going to stay away from you with soft stuff. George Springer, Kevin Kiermaier, two veteran guys, maybe have to cheat a little bit to get to velocity. Maybe have to get their swings started a little bit earlier. Well, okay, we're going to throw you spinning stuff, which, you know, your bat's not going to be timed up with, or maybe it'll just miss your bat entirely. So, you know, there's adjustments to be made here, and guys are working to make those adjustments, whether it's in the batting cages, you see them on the field, Ben, like Matt Haig feeding guys pitches from the breaking ball machine and you know, trying to get their bats kind of timed up to some of the stuff that they're seeing and the way that they're being approached. None of the Blue Jays struggles are for lack of effort or lack of care, or as you said, like a lack of togetherness. It's just been a really unfortunate confluence of a lot of guys underperforming all at once.
Yeah, Matt Haig doing some really good work. I know it's kind of counterintuitive to say about a team that has had so many struggles offensively, but players speak really highly of him, and his role might be something to consider expanding as the Blue Jays move ahead here. Now, we're about to step away, Arden, so I'm going to throw one last question at you real quick.
Sure.
Some players we didn't touch on. Who among these injured players do you think appears back with the Toronto Blue Jays first? Joey Votto rehabbing in Florida. Jimmy Garcia, hopefully set to get off a mound at some point this weekend. Jordan Romano has not progressed to the point that the Blue Jays might have hoped to this point. So among those three, do you think is closest to potentially impacting in the majors?
Jimmy Garcia is closest, I would say. He's been up to like 120 feet from flat ground. As you said, there's optimism he could get off a mound this weekend. Part of the reason why the Blue Jays are pretty motivated to get it back is you want him on a mound and effective and showing what he showed earlier this season, not only because it can help you win, but also because that's one of your better trade assets going into the deadline. You know, as cold as that is to say, the Blue Jays are incredibly incentivized to get this guy back and performing. And also, like, Jimmy's pitching for a contract, right? It's a, you know, it's the end of his deal. So he's going into free agency and he wants to, you know, sign another deal similar to the one that he signed last time with the Blue Jays, which, by the way,
probably a lot more lucrative than that one.
I wonder, at his age, I wonder, right? He'll be like a 34, 35-year-old reliever.
I bet he gets paid.
I bet he gets paid. You think 3 years is going to be out for him out there for
I
him
think
again?
He gets a lucrative two-year deal. Because this last year was it was like 11 over 2. I don't have it in front of me, right? But it was like with an option, which they
ended
exercised.
Ended up being
but
316 or something, 318.
Right. Yeah. And the guaranteed money, I think, was like 11.5, maybe something like that. I bet he gets more guaranteed money this year.
Yeah, 224, something like that. But yeah, so he's pitching for that, right? So he's got to show health and effectiveness. And obviously the Blue Jays would love to cash in on that value at the trade deadline if things continue the way they're going. So yeah, I think Garcia will be back first. He's absolutely ahead of Romano. Romano had that setback, which is really worrying, last weekend. And he's back to throwing from flat ground. But Jimmy is ahead of him. He'll be on a mound before him. And we'll kind of see how things play out with Romano. This is a second elbow issue this year, a second anti-inflammatory injection. If the Blue Jays are uncompetitive for the postseason over the second half, you know, it'll be interesting just how they approach things with Jordan Romano, and you know, whether they're just how quickly they are rushing him back to action, and how they kind of want to approach stuff with the elbow issue, considering how important he would be for them in 2025. For Votto, back in games with Dunedin, had a little bit of a back flare up over the last week as he got things going again. I think he's going to be in Dunedin for some time because the plan is just to get him back into that like swing of playing regularly every day, first base reps, regular plate appearances. He wants to have like a good like workload base. Like the club wants him to have a good amount of plate appearances before he gets up to AAA Buffalo. So I think he'll be in Dunedin for some time. And then once he gets to Buffalo, if he's playing regularly and he's performing and the numbers are there, I mean, that's somebody who could be a factor over the back half of the season. But I don't think you're going to see Joey Votto anytime soon.
You're saying he's not going to be in the lineup on Canada Day?
I would be shocked.
You heard Absolutely it here shocked. First. Breaking news on At the Letters. All right, well, Arden, we covered a lot of ground here, so it is time now for us to step aside. Thank you for the insight. Thanks as well to our producers, Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. And thanks, of course, to everyone who stuck with us through pretty rough season so far. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you soon on At the Letters.